Tip today in association with Slattery's of Pecan, your main Peugeot dealer for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.
Thanks, Sally. Welcome back to the second hour of Tip Today, 1800 938 007. Now, it's good to be joined by our resident GP, Dr. Pat Harold. Good morning to you, Pat.
Morning, Ben.
Good to talk to you today. It appears the worst of the flu season might be behind us, Pat, but there's an outbreak of measles.
Is there?
Don't do that to me, Pat.
Is there? I know. I'll tell you what. There's an outbreak of scarlet fever.
All right.
And I hadn't seen scarlet fever since I was a student. Now it's not that hard to treat, but you'd still want to rock along to the doctor. So they've got these big red cheeks.
Right.
And they're scarlet, you know. Measles are pretty bloody dangerous. Every now and again you hear there's an outbreak of measles. I'm afraid I didn't know about this. But
right, I'm hearing that there's 4 measles cases in Limerick, I'm told.
Is there? Yeah, that's, you need a certain amount of vaccinations to cover the whole place. It's what's called herd immunity, and they want about 90%. And you'd hope most people of the MMR got by now. But it's any kind of spotty kids need to be seen.
Right.
You know, it's don't start to joke. I mean, you've kind of red, watery eyes, and they're pretty sick looking, a runny nose, and you get these little things like grains of salt in your mouth and the inside of your cheek called coptic spots, and then the spots come out. I haven't seen it that often, but it's not a joke. You know, you would really need to be seen if you've the measles.
Right, and is it worse, like for adults, Pat? Is it?
It's not a great solution, whatever age you are.
Yeah.
You know, to be honest, if you get it, look, most people are okay. I don't want to be panicking people. But there's various things that go with the measles that aren't pleasant. You know, people often say, nah, sure, I had measles, I was all right. But if you really question them, it turns out they probably had something else. They might have a German measles, which is rubella, which is, it's not as severe at all. But you would want to keep away from anyone pregnant. You've got that.
Right, okay.
But that's all the time of the year for...
And the German measles and the measles, they're different strains of that, obviously.
They're different bugs altogether, actually. They just called the measles. Everything was called the measles in the old days.
Right,
you know,
okay.
Before you would... Now there's fancy laboratory names for them, like type B or BG something, you know, but in those days, if you had spots, they're probably called variants of the measles. I don't know what the Germans did to people. Called it like Spanish flu. You know, you have to...
Don't mention the war and all of that. Mm. But if I did genuinely have the measles when I was a kid, though, I can't get it again. Is that it?
I wouldn't actually bank on it.
Oh.
You probably can't. But some of these things, they can come back and you can get them a second. You can get chicken pox twice. So it might be a kind of a variant. You know, it might be quite like the one you had. I just make sure all the kids are vaccinated, really. I know that'll probably have people texting in and all that, but it's enough of them are vaccinated.
And where the scarlet fever is concerned, how debilitating is that, Pat? Or how?
Well, if the thing about scarlet fever is it can damage the heart,
right?
If it's not treated, so scarlet fever, they don't really know why that disappeared. 100 years ago, it was rife.
Yeah.
Maybe it was better nutrition or something. We don't really know. Nobody ever worked out about that one because it's not something that you're vaccinated for. It just kind of stopped. Mm. But it seems to be crawling back again.
If I remember correctly, I think it was scarlet fever that caused my father to lose hearing. Would that be right?
When he was young?
Yeah, when he was in his teens.
Right. It could have been that. It could have been the measles too that goes with that. Could have been your piano playing. Sorry,
it could definitely have been that, that's for sure. All right, so anyway, no, that is a HSE warning out about those measles, Pat. So there you are. You see, there you are. We're even informing you, which is great.
All the information I've given you, how time you gave me it back.
Absolutely, for sure. Listen, a lot of people onto us with various different things, Pat, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
Jack was in touch with us. If you have too much calcium in your body, what foods should you avoid and what foods are best to eat? Now, I'm not sure how he knows he has...
No, Jack, that's it. How do you know you have too much calcium in your body? Some people have too much calcium in their body, but I don't think it's from eating butter or something like that. I mean, have you had a blood test? And did the blood test show a high calcium? If I'm doing calcium, somebody too, I like to do it in what's called an uncuffed specimen. if you can, you know the way to put a tourniquet around your arm,
yes,
pop up things that can put it up a tiny bit. So if it comes back high, we generally do that. But there's some conditions that can put up your calcium.
And I
wouldn't think diet is hugely implicated, to be honest.
Right. But I mean, what happens if you have too much calcium? Is it?
They call it stones, bones, and psychic bones, right? Which means you get kidney stones.
Oh.
You get aches and pains in your bone.
Right.
And you can go psychic bones. You can go slightly mad, actually. So that's the trio.
Okay.
It's pretty rare now, but there would be an underlying condition putting up your calcium.
Right.
So if you've got high calcium, you want to see it. Plenty of people are on tablets for calcium and vitamin D because they had osteoporosis or osteopenia, which means thin bones. And now we're beginning to think that most Irish people get plenty of calcium in their diet anyway, especially if you're not a vegan or something. So, most of us are low in vitamin D.
Of course,
you know, unless
yes.
you spend it somewhere abroad or something like that. So a lot of people have probably been taking off their calcium tablets lately and put on vitamin D because loads of calcium can actually fur up your arteries a bit too.
Okay, that's interesting. All right. Somebody on to us to talk about cystitis. A person suffers from cystitis and they're wondering should they stay away from foods like curries and chilies and that sort of thing. Obviously, they're fond of that sort of... What exactly is cystitis, first of all, Pat?
Yeah, cystitis is inflammation of the bladder. It can be caused by a few things. It's generally in women because of the anatomy. It's very easy for bugs to get in. It's very close to the bladder. The opening, you see, so bugs can get in and cause it. And you're kind of peeing knives for a while, and the bladder is irritated. Now, some people do find some foods that really can set off the bladder, and you can take what's called an alkalizing agent, and they can kind of reduce the acidity, because the acidity can really hurt. And then you can bring in a urine sample, and if we think you have an ongoing infection, antibiotics can calm it down.
Right, and some people are more prone to it, I guess.
Oh, some people are martyrs to it.
Oh,
other people can sail away and it doesn't bother them.
Listener says, my son has a glandular fever at the moment. What does Pat have to say about that?
Poor fella. He's going to be absolutely flaked. Now, most of us have been exposed to glandular fever at some stage in our lives. Sometimes it's mild enough, you don't really know you had it. Generally, people come in with a sore throat. It's a thing you often see in colleges, actually, because it kind of goes from teenager to teenager. They used to call it the kissing disease.
Oh.
So it could fly around the place at a weekend, you know, if there wasn't a few decent parties and discos and things on. And then you have typically, not always, no, this is the plan, but typically you'd have a very nasty sore throat and you'd be absolutely wrecked and flattened. And you could be tired for months later. Do you know Hugh Laurie, the actor?
Yes, indeed.
He was training for the British Olympic rowing team and he got infectious mono, which is glandular fever, and he couldn't train or work out or anything like that. So he took to acting for the year and he joined the Cambridge Players with Stephen Fry and all that.
Yeah.
And isn't he glad he did, I'd say.
Isn't
but
he? Yeah.
Now your fella, I don't know if he plays any contact sports, but you just want to be kind of worried because sometimes your spleen can get enlarged with glandular fever. Your spleen is just on your left-hand side, tucked under your ribs, and it can start to stay enlarged for a little while. So if he's playing rugby or Gaelic football and he gets a good dunt into that area, it ruptures his spleen. So he wants to be cleared for takeoff before he goes playing any contact sports.
All right. Vincent wants to know, did you hear of compact regional pain?
I did. It wouldn't be at the forefront of my brain, Vincent.
Right.
But you know what? I could have an answer for you next time.
All right. No
and
more.
I'll put it up there. It's. I think it's kind of... I won't say too much about it today.
Yeah, sure.
we can come back to it.
Jack was back to us about the calcium levels, by the way. He did have a CT angiogram, and that's where it showed up that he had too much of the calcium. So
his calcium deposits in his arteries. Right. I think the best thing you could do, Jack, is you'd be looking at the Mediterranean diet there and reduce dairy products and meat and big time. And you'd also want to, if you want to look up anyone, Patrick Halford has very good books on diet and what to eat and what not to eat. And you'd want plenty of garlic and and olive oil, and get away kind of from dairy, especially.
Do you know, I spoke to him one time in an interview, Mr. Halford, and it's up there in the top five most disappointing interviews I have ever come across, because I loved his work and I loved his books and one thing, and I was dying to talk to him.
Yeah.
And then he came across as a bit of a, you know what, a bleep, 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 but there you go. Speaking of famous people, you wrote a lovely piece in the Times recently about Tony Booth.
Oh, Tony was great.
Tony was one of your patients when you were in Cavan.
Yeah, I knew Tony very well. He was an exotic sort of a fella. Now, younger listeners wouldn't know too much about him. In fact, he was a bit before my time, but he used to be in this program called Till Death Do Us Part, where he basically played himself a long-haired, extremely militant socialist, very proud of his working-class heritage, and he was the father of Sherry Blair, Tony Blair's wife, and he had seven other daughters by a lot of different actresses and models.
Yes. He was a healthy boy in his time.
He was a healthy boy. He had great stories. And he was a very nice fellow. And he'd come in and say, you know, Matt, he'd say, Laurence Olivier never liked me, you know. Where are you going with that? And I'd be sitting watching a film or something. I'd ring him up and say, Tony, how are you doing, boy? How are you doing? And say, you know, what's Michael Caine like? Ah, great guy. Mind you, what film are you watching? That. And he'd be off again. I mean, stuff you just couldn't repeat in the radio, you know.
So wonderful gossip as well.
But he knocked around to Beatles and all these people, you know. So I used to, I had great fun with Tony, but Tony really encouraged me to take up writing. He said, if I couldn't do it without, even though Laurence Olivier didn't like me, you can do it.
Fantastic. He inspired you to write?
Oh, yeah. You know, sometimes, Fran, you meet very creative people in life, and you might be ready to hear it, and people can just, they make things seem possible. You know, there's plenty of people who say, I should, that'll never work, and that wouldn't do it. Why would we do it? We tried it before. But he had none of this sort of attitude at all. It was, everything is possible, and he'd have a crack at anything, you know.
His final wife, if you know what I mean, she was a remarkable lady as well. Was she one of your patients, who Steph?
Oh, yeah.
Steph,
I knew Stephanie, and in fact, I made the introduction to get Stephanie into the Irish Times, because I often say it was a strange kind of a referral. Can you refer us to the Irish Times, you know? And as it happened, I knew people working there as well. So Stephanie wrote for years in the Irish Times, and when Tony got dementia, she wrote absolutely excellent columns about
heartbreaking
living with us. And there'll be a book, no doubt about it. She's got the book. They want, I think, a few people approached her to write a book about it.
Yeah.
So that, I was in touch with her the last day or two, and she's okay, you know, but she's, it's still, I mean, poor Tony only passed away a little while ago.
Yeah, she looked after him so lovingly for so long as well, and she spoke about it, and as you say, wrote about it so beautifully as well. I'm just wondering, Pat, and I almost know the answer straight away to this, but I'd like to hear you tell me anyway. Treating somebody who's very famous like that as a doctor, is that daunting in some way? Or?
Yeah. I remember somebody came in to me one time. I was the girlfriend of a world-famous rock star. Absolutely huge, you know.
Yeah.
And she was looking over at your man. I was completely gobsmacked. And I wouldn't mind, I like his stuff. And, you know, he was kind of a bit daunted facing the doctor, even though I was only a young fella.
Are you serious?
But, you know, as I said in the article, they have the same biology as everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, we all have the same sort of makeup. So, at this stage in my life, I anybody who's famous for this and that, I mean, I wouldn't have a bloody clue who's famous now. You know, they could be number one in the charts, and I wouldn't.
Isn't it great? Yeah. And what about a book out of you, Pat Harold?
Oh, wouldn't I love it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Confessions of a Radio Doctor. I'm listening.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll be the first to read it anyway.
We get you to launch it.
Absolutely. I'm going to keep you to that now, you know that. Let me see. Jack is listening to us right now. He hates garlic, by the way.
Ah, well, Jack, you know, you'll come round. No, yeah, look, Jack, you don't have to stick to it exactly. But, do you know, Jack, if you've got a diagnosis like that, I think, you know, there's a couple of things you could do. Maybe... Sometimes I think if you've got something you've got to live with, there's generally a self-help group. And if you're not too handy in a computer, you could find a teenager who could get you onto it. And people say what worked for them and all that kind of thing. And the other thing you could do is you could have access to a dietitian. Now, dietitians in Ireland are few and far between. But it would be well worth spending a few bob and seeing a professional dietitian and getting advice on that. But Do you know, they've probably put you on medication anyway. They've probably put you on a statin to lower your cholesterol and possibly aspirin, you know. So, and they'll probably follow you up in a few years to see, are the arteries furring up again? And the important thing is not to smoke, because you'd wonder how does smoking fur up your arteries, but it does.
But it does, simple as that. Pat, is always a pleasure. Look after yourself, Pat. And thanks very much indeed. Thank you. Bye-bye to you now. That is our wonderful GP, the great multi-talented Pat Harold, and he writes regularly for the Irish Times. By the way, if you want to have a look at his articles, you can find them all online. 22 past 10 right now. Racism next.
TipFM.com.
A number of weeks ago, I spoke to Áine Ní Chonaill of Immigration Control Platform, which is seeking to restrict immigration to Ireland. Now, the interview, it sparked a huge outcry, with many people claiming that her views were racist, which, of course, she strongly denied. I found it a particularly difficult interview. I found it particularly difficult to remain sort of on the fence, so to speak. Now, in a minute, we'll be speaking to Paul O'Dwyer, who is researching the issue of racism in the workplace at Waterford Institute of Technology's School of Humanities. But first of all, let's just listen back and remind ourselves of some of that interview with Áine Ní Chonaill. We've seen the people drowning and dying. We've seen the children, you know, washed up on beaches and all of that kind of thing. Would you sort of tolerate that happening just to keep immigrants out of this country?
The people that you are speaking of are actually, those crossing the Mediterranean, are invading Europe. And we have a navy down there helping them to do it, which is an absolute disgrace.
They should be allowed to drown, is that it?
They should be repelled. They should be
forced back and not allowed
to reach Europe.
Repelled is what do you mean by that now?
I mean the usual word used in the discourse is pushback. You should not have them coming to Europe.
They should be forced back, no matter what their conditions of their place of birth is. They should be pushed back there.
Pushed back to the shore from which they came. Yes.
And if that means allowing them to drown,
if you're pushed back to the shore, you don't drown.
That's a fairly incredible. I'm aghast at that.
Well, I imagine you are, because you are.
Because I don't like to see children drowning.
And this is how it goes. We talk about children. We don't talk about adults. It's all. Oh, whenever I hear the word child, I know I'm dealing with somebody with an agenda.
I don't have any agenda on you.
Oh yes, it is.
But I mean, I don't have an agenda, except I hate to see children.
Oh, there you go again. Would you mind explaining to me what's the difference between a man, woman and a child? I thought all human beings were equal.
Oh, they are, but you know, the sight of a child... Sorry, I'm a father myself, so you'll forgive me if I'm particularly taken at the sight of a child drowning, you know?
No, actually, I won't. I expect you to realise that you're meant to take the image of the child, and you're not meant to sit back and say, a human being.
Right,
and
right.
And you're also not meant
well,
to... Well,
a human being. I hate to see anybody drowning.
Right.
And I would be willing to put up with us missing out on a few bob if that meant that I could take in these people and mind them in some way.
You're the only person since this conversation began who has mentioned money.
But come on, you said it was problematic to us. I mean,
I'm talking about socially, I'm not talking about monetarily. But since you brought it up now, and you brought it up several times, we have...
Are you a racist, Áine?
I'm not even going to answer that.
Paul O'Dwyer is with me. Paul, you're shaking your head listening to that. Your thoughts?
Where do I start, Fran? It was brought up, the drowning of refugees crossing, and one of them that was brought up, and Áine jumped down your throat about it, was the death of Alan Curdy,
yeah,
who washed up on an Italian beach, unfortunately. She jumps down your throat saying, you're supposed to pick up the child, the image of the child. A human is a human, regardless of age. She talked about the way that the Navy, the Irish Naval Service, is down there on an assignment.
Yeah.
In 2015, the Italian and Irish governments set up a bilateral agreement between their relative naval services for a humanitarian operation known as Operation Pontus. Now, we know the Navy managed to save thousands of lives. Late last year, we then joined Operation Sophia, also known as the European Naval Force Mediterranean. Now, that's a full European-wide operation with seven mission objectives. Three of those, I think, are important to this. contribute to disrupt the business of human smuggling and trafficking in the Mediterranean, contribute to prevent loss of life at sea, and enhance the possibility for sharing information on human trafficking with member states' law enforcement agencies. All that is counter to the human smuggling and to keep people alive. That's the idea of sending the Navy down there.
Only use the word repelled. They should be pushed back to their own shores. Repelled was the word she used.
She also said by pushing them back, they won't drown. That's, where's the logic in that? She also said that they're invading Ireland or invading Europe. They're not. They're fleeing absolute hell, violence, famine, all sorts. Didn't we do the same during the famine? We fled from just sheer...
Now, I put that argument to her as well, and she pshawed it, really, and said, you know... would you see Áine as racist?
Some of her views, yes. When I was picking apart her argument before I came in here today, there were some of the stats she brought up which I couldn't understand. She said in 1998 the phenomenon of immigration to Ireland began due to asylum seeker requests. It didn't. In the 1920s, the 1940s, we brought refugees to Ireland from the two world wars. In 1956, we brought over a number of Hungarian refugees to Limerick, escaping Soviet occupation. Yeah. In 1999, Dermot McAleese, the CSO in 2003, and the National Economic and Social Council, along with the International Office of Migration in 2006, all pointed to the change to net migration in Ireland being caused by various factors, including our economy developing, the European Union expansions, and our changes to work visa requirements for international staff. She brought it up a couple of times that EU nations they've gone further than what they thought they would with migration, but she provided no reference to it. So in her argument, she's saying that Europe has gone too far. I can't see where she's going with that. She provided no basis to it. She said to you then, Fran, 1-2% of non-Irish in Ireland around 1998. If you go off the 1996 census, 7% of the persons in Ireland on census night were non-national. 1.1% from Northern Ireland, 4.2% from Great Britain, 0.5% from the other EU nations, 0.8% from the USA, and 0.7% from other nations around the world. So 1.6% of Ireland's population, excluding the UK, was non-Irish. But if you include the UK, it's 7%. She talked about the work visas. She said 9,000, I think roughly was the number she said. Off the same article that she was talking about, it said 10,500. I was listening to it last night, the podcast, to just make sure of my argument, and she talked about a senior civil servant talking about international students. Now, as a postgrad below in Waterford IT, there I see a wealth of international students, and the value they have is unbelievable. She said that with their student visas, they are allowed to stay for a year after they complete their studies to try and find work, to get a work visa or a green card. But she makes out they should be sent home afterwards.
Mm. Is it true that they can stay?
As far as I'm aware, they can stay.
Okay. I'm just wondering what you think. How widespread do you think would Áine's views be?
Not as widespread as I first thought.
Yeah.
I mentioned your interview with her to a number of colleagues and friends. And like your texters, the majority of responses were negative to her rather than supporting her. Now, there was one or two, obviously, that did support her, but they're entitled to their views. That's the joy of Irish society. It's in our constitution that we are allowed free speech. And under Article 40.6.1, but I think Áine and some of her followers forgot that when she was talking to you, because she wouldn't let you voice your opinion.
Do you think that, there is a danger, in fairness to Áine, there's a danger that when you do discuss the whole business of immigration and that racism is brought into it, even though you might be discussing it just in a way, in an economic way, for example. There is that danger, isn't it?
Yeah.
That if you do question immigration in any way, you're seen as being a racist.
Yeah. I've seen that come up a couple of times. And one thing I'd say is, and it came up actually in an interview I did for my research, when we're talking economics, there is a certain jobs that the Irish, for some reason, were just not applying for it. And one legal professional I talked to, he actually said to me, from a case he has represented on, international staff came over from, I think it was somewhere in the Far East, was doing their job as a care assistant, but was accused of being aggressive towards staff, and there was a complaint made against them. The complaint was found to be false, and the complainant was made pay compensation. Now, that was a client of the healthcare facility. If you look at the economics of it, look at the various industries. Look at construction during the boom time. If it wasn't for the international staff, we would have struggled. And now construction is coming back again, so we need the international staff. Going back to the international students that we were talking about a minute ago, if we bring them over on scholarships and whatever, and we pay for them to be here, and then we send them home, that doesn't make sense. Like, why would a company, we'll use myself for example, why would a company hire me, spend all their time, money and resources training me, only for me to leave and go to another company? Makes no sense. We keep those graduates, they'll be valuable to the economy down the line. On your brought up unemployment and immigration, that we should help the 244,000 on the live register, the 18.5 million in Europe. She said, she was on about that. You'll never have 0% unemployment. Now, I'm walking the fine line. I'd say I'll get backlash over this, but there's always
What is it? We accept about 5.5 or something like that as being complete employment. Yeah,
like if you had 0% on unemployment. If the amount of staff, the amount of workers available outweighs the number of jobs available, employers can lower the wages.
Right.
But if there's more worker, or if there's more jobs available than there is workers to do them, wages go up.
Right.
Inflation goes up.
It's a workers' market at that point. Making an impact, is that what your research is called? Is it?
No, Making an Impact was a competition that I won alongside Laura Kerr from Maynooth University. It was ran by the Higher Education Authority and the Irish Independent. I made an impact that day, obviously, on the audience and the judges that I was one of the winners from it, and I hope my research makes an impact itself. Right.
And the research, institutional racism in the Irish workplace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Part of that, I've done a case review of 280 cases before the Equality Tribunal and the Workplace Relations Commission. A number of those cases, or all those cases, practically all of them involve international complainants, be they from Europe, the US, the UK, or the rest of the world. In one case, there was a woman, this goes back to the unemployment point now, I know I'm jumping all over the place, but there was a woman who was working for a retail chain. She was the de facto manager. She was practically the manager, but de jure, in law, she was a deputy manager. And when she went on maternity leave and then came back, she wasn't even the junior manager. She was demoted and she was later dismissed. Now, she took a case and won on the grounds of constructive dismissal. In that case, an Irish comparator was found, an Irish woman who worked alongside the complainant, and she said it herself. She was the only Irish person working in that place, and no Irish person would tolerate the working conditions because it was pretty much slave labour, and that's what the Equality Tribunal said. It was fraudulent the way they were using the junior managers.
And how common is that, do you think, in other companies or in companies in Ireland?
From what I've found through my own work and through the interviews I've conducted, it was common, but it's being more and more dealt with now. Employers are realising the value of international staff. You look at the likes of Facebook, Google, all the big multinationals. Diversity is what makes them as good as they are. You look at large national companies, it's the same thing. Multinational staff bring new ideas, it makes the company better. The medium and small enterprises, they're catching up now and they're seeing it. And I've seen it that with the interviews I've conducted, they're trying their best to avoid discrimination.
And is our legislation and our laws comprehensive enough, do you think, to cover this kind of racism, institutional racism that's in workplaces?
To a point, yes. When the legislation first came out in 1998, the Employment Equality Acts, we were pretty much leaders in Europe regarding it. But now in 2018, 20 years later, it could do it a bit of a redo, I think.
Yeah.
Some people have agreed with me, some people haven't. But that's just our experience of the legislation and how we've looked at it.
Yeah, a listener on to us say, Fran, a non-EU national who gains citizenship received financial supports from the Department of Social Protection to compete with me in a small town and to gain an advantage, offered the same service at half price or less to take my customers. Is that something that you would have come across?
I wouldn't have come across anything like that now, in that it's company versus company. It's more internal, what I've seen.
Right, okay.
Where it would be staff pinching customers off each other, stuff like that.
Okay, yeah, right. How much further will you go with this, Paul? Or what's your ideas for the future now that you've finished this amount of research? And
I'll finish. I'm supposed to be finished by June, touch wood.
Right.
Hopefully I'll be out of there. My two supervisors will finally get some peace and peace and quiet.
Right.
I do intend on going further with this field,
yeah.
But for the time being, I need to focus on the Masters and get that finished out before I can go further. There is a lot of avenues I could go down with this field,
yeah.
And it's kind of, where do I go is the next question.
Right. I'm sure it's very, very interesting. I'm just wondering how it would transfer to other countries. Is this something you could see yourself working outside of Ireland with as well? Because
I could, in a way. When I first started out the project, myself, my lead supervisor, Jonathan Cullerton, and my co-supervisor, Dr. Jennifer O'Mahony, we looked at other countries to see, has anyone else done something like this?
Mm.
Now, other countries around the world have done similar research, but they haven't done it in the line I'm doing it in, as in within the workplace.
Right.
They've looked at other sectors, so the criminal justice system, healthcare, stuff like that. They haven't dug into the workplace. So I'm kind of stepping into the unknown, but...
Well, it's certainly very interesting and enlightening work. Paul, it's a pleasure to see you again, and the best of luck with finishing up.
Cheers, Fran.
In June.
I'll need that luck.
Will it be a publication then? I mean, or will it work like a thesis? Is that
It'll be a thesis that I'll submit, hopefully, middle of May, fingers yeah. crossed. And after that, then, the thesis will be held on record in WIT's main campus.
Right.
But I will be contactable if anyone wants a copy once it's finished.
Oh.
It should be easy enough to get a copy to them, either digital or printout.
All right, Paul, good to see you, and thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Fran.
That's Paul O'Dwyer speaking to us today. 1800-938-007. We'll be talking about some of the foods that will be in the top 10 of stuff we'll crave in 2018, just after these.
If it matters to you, it matters to us. Call TIP today on 1-800-938-007.
Anybody for moringa or broccoli slaw? Well, Ireland's leading online food and drink magazine, thetaste.ie, has compiled the top 10 food trends to look out for in 2018. The magazine says when it comes to food trends, things are moving very quickly this year. So to tell us more, I'm joined now by Erica Bracken, features editor at taste.ie. Erica, good morning to you.
Good morning, Fran. How's all in Tipperary?
They're all extremely well in Tipperary. I would imagine we're all rubbing our hands together and saying, when can we get this broccoli slaw?
It's not as bad as it sounds. give the broccoli stem slaw a chance, you know.
Okay, so tell us what we can look forward to tease our taste buds for 2018.
Well, here today, like, a part of our job is to keep in track of what's happening right now, but also what's coming down the line. So this year, we're predicting that, again, plant-based and environmentally friendly diets will be really popular. Because as you know yourself, people are becoming so much more conscious about how much more meat they're consuming and also about the waste they're producing. So, you know, there's always a few quirky ones. And we've all heard of the superfoods. So this year's new superfood is Moringa. Have you heard of Moringa?
Only since I started reading up on it from taste.ie, to be honest with you. What exactly is it, Erica?
So, like, we've, as I said, adaptogenic herbs or spices, so there's such things like maca powder you might have heard of, or spirulina. Although they've become quite mainstream, you can get them in Aldi now. So Moringa is the new one, and it's from the Moringa tree. So it's been used in indigenous medicine in Southeast Asia for hundreds of years, and it's just now it's kind of making its way over to the West in powder form. So we're not eating the fresh leaves. And what you do basically, just like you would put, let's say, wheatgrass or something like that into your smoothie, you can do the same with Moringa. And it has twice as much protein as spinach and three times as much iron. So it's a really nutrient-dense, rich powder to add. And you can add it to things like soups and smoothies as well. But also another way to use it is in lattes. So instead of your coffee element of the latte, you can use your steamed milk and add in a little, do make a little paste with your Moringa powder. And there you go, you have your latte.
And is there a taste to it, Erica?
I haven't tasted it. I am a big fan now of the green taste that you get with spirulina, but apparently it tastes quite mild and just a little grassy. So I guess if you blend it up with other things and you put it on top of your soup or drink it into your smoothie, it's got to mask the flavor, but you'll still get all the nutrients, vitamins and minerals that are really concentrated in the Moringa.
All right. Is it expensive?
It's like those things, as I said, like it is expensive now, but we're predicting that it will become less expensive. As I said, Aldi have brought out their own range of functional foods. And that's the title that they call them. And you can get like maca for about €5, €6, whereas it might be like 12 or 13 elsewhere.
Okay.
So like, as we said, as it becomes more, you know, more popular, it will drop in price and become more available to people.
I was also interested to see on taste.ie that floral flavors will be introduced more.
Yeah.
And they're not really all that much in our foods at the moment, sure they're not.
Exactly. Well, actually, just talking about the lattes, that's one way that we will see floral flavors making a comeback. So you'll get lavender lattes and rose petal lattes, and obviously sprinkles with the lovely pink rose petals, they'll definitely make a good Instagram moment. But as you said, yes, fruit flavors have dominated. Like, we wouldn't think of, everything seems to be, strawberry flavored, banana flavored, but we definitely have been overlooking floral flavors to date. But there is a trend that we've noticed. So Alpro, for example, so they produce non-dairy ice cream and yogurt. They're after bringing out an apricot and orange blossom soy yogurt in Germany. And more close to home than Roundtree's brought out fruit and floral fusions, and there was an apple and elderflower pastille there. So it's, I think it's a taste we need to get our palates around and become a lot more familiar with.
I would imagine it's just acquired just a little bit. I had to do a double take when I read about vegan fast food.
So obviously veganism is a huge trend right now, and people are probably just finished their veganery, but hopefully... Are you familiar with veganery?
No.
So basically...
Couldn't be huge here in Tipperary, Erica.
So that's when people take up veganism for the month of January.
Right.
So it's really, really took off on social media. People are really documenting their, new recipes, trying this out. Obviously, there's a benefit to your health, the environment. So it really took off this year. So we're hoping that people will, keep on, at least some days a week into February, now that we're in the new month. But I think, obviously, vegans need a little bit of guilt-free junk food too. And so we're seeing a trend at the plant-based fast food. So it started in New York, but there's this very, as I said, very Instagram-friendly New York cafe called By Chloe. And they serve up, like, pesto meatballs, guacamole burgers, kelp noodles. And it's become really popular. It's actually popped up in Covent Garden in London now as well.
Wow.
And kind of more close to home, McGuinness's Takeaway on Camden Street in Dublin is claiming to be the first chipper in the country to offer an entirely vegan menu. And so they actually have a completely separate deep fat fryer and all that for the vegan stuff, so there's no cross-contamination that way. But there's items on the menu, like, and I actually pass it on my way home from yoga most days, and I'm like, one of these days, and it's going to pop in for chickpea kebabs and chicken-style nuggets. Just to kill the curiosity, because I'm as curious as you are.
Well, I'm very curious about it indeed. If people want to go on to taste.ie, they can find the rest of those foods that will be trending for 2018. Erica, good to talk to you today. Thanks very much indeed. Thank you. Bye-bye to you now. So everybody can head out a little later on and get your dose of Moringa and see how it goes down well with your lavender latte and all of that. Let's take a break. We're back with a look at your texts in just a few moments.
Join the conversation in Tipperary. Contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email tiptoday@tipfm.com.
And Trudy is with me. Trudy, you have something to read out, haven't you?
Yes, residents in Terryglass, they held, this was the first of their a public meeting. This is over the state of the Roran Road there in that beautiful picturesque village. Yeah. So basically, you know, a plan of action. They held that 1 hour, I suppose, blockade there earlier this week. So now they met last night, around 30 or 40 residents in the village hall to decide on a strategy going forward. They obviously heard from the locals and they heard from local representatives, because they're pointing out that despite numerous efforts taking over the years to elicit repairs to that 1.7 kilometre stretch, it's now been allowed to deteriorate to a point which has forced residents to close it last week. So the meeting heard concerns of those present and how the poor road quality is providing a challenge on a daily basis for people. So basically, they were keen to have their collective voices heard, and going forward they're going to have a number of demonstrations, and they're going to start that. The first will be a peaceful protest that will be outside the county council offices in Nina this coming Monday between 12 noon and 1 p.m. and the statement goes on to say they have a lot of support from the locals and the local councillors present, and they hope it's the beginning of something. And actually on that, and we've had a lot of issues over roads over the last few days, you know, we've heard the roads in Thurles and Tiptown, right across the county, the roads here up in North Tipperary. Yeah. Well, there's a new group forming, the Lower Ormond Road Action Group, and they're basically covering the Lower Ormond area, and they're going to have a public meeting on Monday, the 12th of February, about action that they're going to take, because obviously the Lower Ormond has really suffered, so we'll be hearing more about that next week.
All right, Trudy, thanks very much indeed for that. We will get back to your text in the next hour of the programme as well, we promise you that. By the way, our vet, Mairead, will be talking to us very soon, so if you have an issue with your dog, your cat, your hamster, your goldfish, whatever, if you log it with us now, 083 311 3311.